I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Indie Football Podcast. Today I'm delighted to be joined by the sports editor of The Independent, Ben Burrows, chief football writer Miguel Delaney, and features writer Vatushan Ahantaraja. And this is the second part of our Why Football is Broken podcast. We released the first part of this pod on January the 22nd. It's called How Good is Liverpool Being Good? So make sure to check that out if you haven't already listened to it. In that show, we spoke a lot about the implications of Liverpool's current level of dominance, as well as the criticism of FIFA's plans to overhaul the Club World Cup. This week, we're going to expand on those discussions a little bit, and we're also going to talk about Miguel's most recent piece, which you may have seen pop up once or 10 times on Twitter. It's cheerfully called How Football Became Broken Beyond Repair. And it's a comprehensive look at how unpredictability in modern football is in danger of dying a death. It's a very good piece of work. Miguel, before we get stuck into the piece itself, do you want to maybe talk about the kind of defining moments of the last few seasons that made you lock yourself in your flat for 10 days and write 6,000 words? What was the kind of genesis of the piece?
It has really been a growing thing. As someone said to me today, basically, like there's been a few pieces of the past while I've touched on this. I think the first time I really kind of did it properly was around 2014 after Madrid beat Atletico in the Champions League. Because even though that was such a close game, it was a symbolic moment in that the inches were so tight and yet the consequences were so vast. It was a Sergio Ramos last minute equaliser, but even still, then you've got would have meant everything to Atletico. It was obviously Madrid's first Champions League at that point 12 years and La Decima. But it was if like that those small margins reflected actually the gulf between the clubs and how the super clubs ultimately always just it comes around to them. Because the previous year, of course, in a similar situation, a Champions League final went down to the last minute and the bigger club Bayern Munich beating the smaller club in context Borussia Dortmund. And so it's since then it's really kind of, and this whole idea of super clubs, it's always been there in the back of my mind. I think it's become the most important. It's basically what explains modern football. It's finances more than ever before. I mean, if you go back to the 80s, and I touched on this of the piece, Liverpool are obviously dominating everything, but you can't put it back to finance in the same way because the numbers just aren't big enough. You still have a situation where Brighton have two of the best paid players in the country, one of them being Michael Robinson, who's famous in Spain, where squads are ultimately too small to just have the same effect. And it's really since the 80s and changes since the 80s that grows to we get to this point that's really happened since about 08, 09 and 10, which is the start of all these massive clubs getting doubles and trebles and record seasons, where the main differential in football is finance. And, you know, people can go on about, oh, well, like, you know, it's about the evolution of attacking football, it's about certain coaches, but ultimately they're all part of that system as well because the best coaches will gravitate towards the top of the game.
I suppose if you had to boil all 6,000 words down into one sentence, it would be something along the lines of the core unpredictability of football is being eroded by this financial disparity. Is that fair? And what was the most damning thing you found when researching and writing this?
I still think the one that stands out the most is the Real Madrid-Barcelona stat, in that just it's the amount, because I think this is what's really striking, and actually this was something else that prompted it. I remember when Football Leaks came out last year and all that stuff about City, and then that very week City play Southampton, and as I think it was Ken Early to put it to on their pod Second Captains, but you have basically Manchester City, you know, spend 50 million on the best lawyers you can buy against Shane Long Southampton, and it ends 6-1. And that kind of like, it's the fact that these wins are becoming more and more normal. So from the decade 2000 to 2009, Real Madrid and Barca only win 17.8% of their games by three goals or more. So what, a heavy victory. Whereas in the last 10 years, that's shot up to 38%, or to 38.8%. And it's absolutely massive. So 40% of their games almost are basically just non-events in terms of a contest.
We want to get stuck into some of the reasons for why that is happening. If I can bring in you guys, I suppose one true watershed moment that Miguel kind of gets stuck into in his pieces is obviously the formation of the Champions League and then the prize money from the Champions League entrenching the clubs that are already in it.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I think that's one of the key points of the piece, is that it's this status quo, and then if so, only so many people can reach this point and then they get the money back, then they have then got an incredible advantage to go back in there and do it again. I think it's a stat in the piece that between 90 and 95, the same amount of people got into the top four as in the entirety of the 2000s. So if you actually look at that, that's absolutely insane. And that is a direct proof of what Miguel's been saying, in that the unpredictability and competitiveness basically at the very top of the game is changing. And like Miguel says, it's almost all, there are other factors, but it's almost all down to this financial imbalance.
It's not a particularly sexy topic, but if we move on to financial fair play, is it fair to say that it's failed? Miguel wrote that the legislation came too late. Rather than creating a necessary competitive balance in European football, it reinforced the pre-existing levels. So is the problem here that by tying a club's spending to their revenue, FFP has simply ring-fenced the elite?
Well, the issue here is something you see a lot in sport across the world, where there is a problem to address and they address it too late and they end up addressing the wrong part of the problem. They're basically, you know, trying to stop the dam from overflowing rather than thinking, actually, just go back to the source and let's sort it out earlier down the, you know, down the chain, as it were, or further up the chain. You know, we've seen it with City, haven't we? The fact that, you know, I think you touched on it there about the lawyers that Ken Early mentioned, that when you get to that level, you're going to be able to fight whatever people throw your way. You either don't have the clout to deal with these clubs anymore, and they didn't when they brought in this legislation. So, you know, as Miguel touched on in his piece, that they're just, I think they've got to a point where they're too strong now, that it doesn't matter what you bring in, unless you actually put in something like a salary cap or something that really actually hamstrings them, for want of a better word, then we're not really going to see any progress. You know, you look at the title there and it's the game broken beyond repair. I think that is a problem. When you read Miguel's piece, you don't come out with any solutions, because really, are there any?
We've got the piece tomorrow, and it's... Are we allowed to discuss that, actually, before we go?
We'll talk about it in the second part. Okay. I mean, one thing I wanted to pick up on from what you just said, Vish, even if City or PSG or whoever you like, even if they were banned from the Champions League for a season or for two seasons or whatever, would it change anything?
I think that would be one of the worst things that they could do, because as soon as they try and ostracise one of those big clubs, we're going to get further towards having some kind of Super League.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you exclude them, this is the thing about UEFA's power, you know, that as soon as you push them a bit further back, as soon as you start trying to take it out on them, they're just going to lash back tenfold, because they've got the clout to do that, whether that's financially or also just the fan base as well. People do want to see the best versus the best, fundamentally. That's why you get, you know, for example, one of the things, it's gone a bit off track here, but one of the things I enjoyed about Miguel's piece is when he tweeted it, so many people were in agreement with him. And you know, Miguel, your mentions at the best of time are a bin fire, because you deal with these kind of issues on a regular basis, and you end up getting fans from City, from Liverpool, from Barcelona, from Real Madrid, just absolutely trying to take you down. And that fan base that has got so feral now that, you know, they couldn't care less if they're not playing the Premier League. If they're playing, you know, if they're in an eight-team league playing the best in the world, round and round playing against Ronaldo's, Messi's, and whoever else, then they're going to be pretty happy with that, aren't they?
But what's always amazing in those situations is that fans who probably consider themselves quite left-wing, economically left-wing in normal life, then become ultra-capitalist when it comes to their football club. And you get all sorts of stuff. Well, fuck, that's life. Some people are just bigger and wealthier than others. Deal with it. When, you know, we're meant to be railing against this stuff and everything. And I suppose this is the point that, I mean, even if that is life, and tragically that's where we are in kind of society, sport is one area that doesn't need to be. Like, its organising principle doesn't inherently have to be uber-capitalism. Look, I mean, and again, the great irony that people turn to so often is the structure of American sports that are, you know, because they recognise what competition, or the... that the what is so attractive about sport is competition. So they have loads of checks and regulations in to protect that. Now, of course, these are some of the wealthiest franchises in the world, but it's still the organizing structure is still equitable and democratic. But and in football is anything but.
Have you been surprised by the reaction?
A little bit, actually. Also, because you wonder, it is supposed such a dense topic with so many factors to it. You kind of you're almost worried that at the start it won't take off, but I suppose it did. I suppose what you really want is that articles like this actually affect change. But that's a bigger discussion. But yeah, even like some Liverpool fans who would previously have criticised me when I did that piece in January, and this is really just an extension of that piece. Some of them have been saying, I've got a few saying they, we can't actually disagree.
It's interesting because I guess many of the critics will say, oh, what about Leicester City winning the Premier League or Sheffield United getting really close now or Man United falling away? And it's something that you point out in the piece is that this is still fundamentally a human game. So it's all about mistakes. And it's a good line about the penalty spot being so far away to make it 70% chance of scoring.
The Leicester thing is very interesting as well because it's quite a weird... I mean, it's both been a massive positive for the game, obviously, and actually a massive negative because it means anyone arguing for these structures can basically point to Leicester and go, look, this is still possible. Yeah. When the whole reason Leicester was so magic was actually because of the amount of inherent inhibitions to it. So that's not a good... So the fact... A club like Leicester, we're still a big English club... The fact this was so almost impossible for them and that they so defied the odds, that's not something to be celebrated, even if their achievement is. And it's almost like Leicester is the great... it's caused a bit of deception for people because then they're tricked into thinking this is possible when actually it's still a massive exception. And it's also caused a reaction among the big clubs who, as I opened the piece with, then kind of firmly believe, you know, we don't want too many Leicesters. And I was going to bring this up in a later piece, but it's worth mentioning in the pod as well. Even in European football, apparently, there were figures of kind of big clubs. Suddenly when Leicester were in the Champions League and gone quite far in it, they got to the quarters. So some of the, like people from big clubs in Europe going, hang on, they're not part of the gang. So, yeah.
Vish, you obviously write widely about other sports. Have you encountered similar structural problems when reporting on other sports, or do you think this is becoming a kind of uniquely football problem?
No. Wherever there's money, it's always going to be a problem, isn't it? Where people try and ring fence the game. In terms of, I suppose, the sport that sticks out to me that has been doing this for a while is cricket. I think it was 2014 where India, Australia and England, having realised that they're the three teams that are bringing the most money whenever they play each other, whenever they tour elsewhere, they came together and basically demanded a bigger slice of the pie from the ICC. And with that, they basically took money out of the pockets of other four nations, other associate nations, and got to a stage where they were basically dictating the game. You only need to look at how many times England played Australia in ODIs and Tests and T20s over the last 3 or 4 years. It used to be, you know, they'd play each other twice in 3 years, and now, you know, Australia coming for ODIs later this summer. And yeah, it's really an absurd situation they're into. The difference is with cricket is because it's such a small ecosystem that when the complaints were made, they were heard and they were listened to. And 2017, they rolled back that a bit. It's still not parity. You know, those three still take a bigger slice of the pie, but it certainly is much better. But again, I suppose in cricket, because India are the superpower, you're always beholden to them. So, for example, if they decided to take their ball home and play amongst themselves, they could do that. 2017, the IPL broadcast rights at home went for $1.7 billion, and that's just to an Indian audience. So, you know, they could be happily playing amongst themselves. It just so happens that the players want to play international cricket. That's not to say in 20 years' time that they might not turn around and think, well, actually, why don't we could have a more comfortable life, we just play each other at home and we can get them to come to us.
Well, isn't that as well why the World Cup structure is as it is?
Well, exactly that, yeah. So, you know, you've got... Basically, in the 2007 World Cup in the Caribbean, there was supposed to be, they'd orchestrated it this way, there was supposed to be a second stage game between India and Pakistan. Now, because of a series of upsets, which should be celebrated in sport, it ended up being Ireland versus Bangladesh. And from that point on, they thought, right, this is not going to happen again. So they deliberately made it a 10-team World Cup. And it's even in the World T20 that's happening later this year, T20 is... you know, probably the most meritocratic format cricket has, in that it'd be a bit like playing one set of tennis. Anyone can win set, regardless of who's, you know, the standard. But they've even tried to kind of take the romance out of that, where they've got a qualifying tournament before. So instead of having a 16 team, you know, four groups of four, you know, a bit of excitement, they're having 16, well, seven teams play off to be into that final part of the tournament. And yeah, they've kind of stripped the magic away from it. And it's like, but as I said before, because cricket's so small, that kind of, you know, the people who are rallying against it are being heard, and progress is being made bit by bit. The issue with football is, no matter how much noise you make, it's such a bigger ecosystem.
That point about the Bangladesh-Ireland game, I mean, that's, I think, such an interesting thing in this. And I was thinking about this even from my own perspective, and how, and because a major issue in this is ultimately how seductive the biggest games are, and how much, I mean, over the next few weeks, we're going to be absolutely salivating over the Champions League knockout stages. And even like football's equivalent of Ireland-Bangladesh, probably the 2002 World Cup, where everyone's, you know, really excited about all these upsets. And then suddenly it gets to the semi-finals or the quarter-finals, and it's, you know, Korea against Turkey. When hang on a second, I want Brazil-Argentina here. And like, there's always that double think. And it's because basically we're so attracted to these biggest games, which these clubs know. And it's why there's this debate about the football calendar now. Ultimately, clubs like Liverpool, Real Madrid, they don't want to be playing domestic cup games against Shrewsbury or Valladolid. They want to play against the biggest matches because it's worth the most money. And when we're kind of party to that, because ultimately we're willingly pay for this service. And it's, we've written about this as well. I think this is another step on the road to this piece, but it's that dual thing about the Champions League, that on one side it's so predictable, and then on the other side, because of that and because of the way the competition is constructed, it then becomes this brilliantly unpredictable knockout stage that is probably the highest level of sport because of these inequalities.
This is actually something that I was going to ask you coming in here, because I saw a thread by I think it's pronounced Omar Chowdhury of the 21st Club, and he talked about how, you know, what the points, he agreed with the points you raised, and also said, kind of, as consumers, we need to look at ourselves, because if we're continuing to buy this product, then we can't turn around and be like, oh, you know, for example, it's a bit like the iPhone, isn't it? We can't complain when the battery runs down when we just keep buying new ones. And I thought that was quite interesting, because I don't necessarily agree with him, but I also wonder, you know, as people who work in the media, as people who consume football, is there anything we can actually do? Like, how much could we actually row back on what we've already done?
But this is a circular problem as well, and that's probably when Ben should come in on, I suppose, to want to make these decisions. Because ultimately, like, even the media, as much as you try to do kind of worthy pieces and clubs lower down, you do it, and there's no response because people aren't that interested. So which basically means, well, I have to, part of the media is, as well as telling people what needs to be known, it's also about responding to what people are interested in and what's in the public interest.
Well, yeah, precisely. It's tricky. It's sort of like you want to shine the light on every story there is, but some stories are worth more than others, and that's sort of the problem you're going to have in football now. It's why the Champions League, like Miguel has written more than once, that's why it is the highest standard of football there is, and it's why the World Cup, now going from 32 to 40 teams, is being diluted. And it basically means this last 16 knockout of the Champions League is the best standard of sport there is, basically. It's something we'll move on to, I'm sure, but it's that kind of thinking that makes you think, well, how bad would a European Super League actually be? Because we would still inevitably have to cover it on Saturday night in prime time or whatever it is. But then, should you? It's one of those sort of tricky balances.
And a classic example of what we're talking about here, I suppose. Remember, 2.5 years ago, I was part of a group of journalists brought to an update on the investigation into historic sexual abuse cases in football, which obviously one of the worthiest issues in football, and like Danny Taylor's coverage has been so groundbreaking and also caused such a stir. And I did a piece on the update, and I can't remember the line now, but there was actually, they did give us new info, and that got something like 900 readers in 900 page views, something like that in total, which, you know, points to this kind of bind the media are in, that we have to cover what needs to be covered, and yet that still has to be balanced, because to do that, you actually have to do what makes you financially viable as well, which is covering.
It's like what you said before the pod, Ben. I mean, we still cover the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, and we still covered Joshua's fight against Ruiz in Riyadh. Extending this further, do we think that football fans have a responsibility then to kind of be moral arbiters of the game when the government and the powers that be and the sanctioning bodies aren't doing anything?
Well, on that, I think we've got a perspective on this having come from Ireland. Because the Irish League has basically been ravaged by its proximity to Premier League. And Ireland's actually probably been a bit of a foreshadow a lot of this, I think, even 20 years in advance. Because in the 60s, basically, you know, clubs like Shamrock Rovers used to get crowds of at least 20,000. Match of the Day started to be shown in Ireland in the late 60s, and that was that. Suddenly, local crowds started to plummet, and everyone was attracted to the glamour of the Premier League. And I suppose the ultimate thing is that if you actually care about football, on an individual basis, do you have a personal responsibility to go to your local club? Because, it is your agency in this sense. Yeah. I mean, right, no one's expecting you to not watch top-level football. It's kind of impossible to ask. But maybe start to at least invest in your local club as much as you do the major clubs.
We're going to come on to a lot of that in the second half of the pod. Just before we head to a break, we're going to answer a few questions because we had a lot of feedback to the first pod and also, obviously, to Miguel's piece. The first question is one we've received loads of times. Some people say it in a really arsey way, but it's fairly valid. If super clubs are the problem, then why do you spend all your time talking about them?
Which is kind of just what we just covered there, yeah. Because everyone's interested in them.
Because that's what gets the clicks.
Yeah.
Another point that's been raised numerous times, how can you possibly lump in Liverpool with Manchester City when their money has been generated through the success of the club rather than a mega-rich takeover?
Because that is the entire point, that there's only a handful of clubs now that have a global fan base, and if you want to put it in Ferran Soriano business terms, have an active market that they can capitalise on. And everything in the game is loaded towards the clubs that can do that. It means they'll get exponentially richer. And now the only way you can actually compete with that, which is not to say this is a good thing, are mega takeovers.
That's a well-practiced answer. last question for now from somebody called The Hound. Could a European Super League actually be good for English football? If you take away the richest clubs, then it would increase the competitiveness of domestic football, let them have their fun. And somebody else called Hugh messaged in, the European Super League is a good way to go as long as there's no promotion or relegation. It will be watched by those who want to see success but with no soul.
See, I get that argument, and we're at the unfortunate point where the game is so broken that this is almost desirable. And yet, one of the beauties of football is actually, even though it's become a problem, is its global structure and the idea that, I mean, theoretically in England, you can go from the bottom to the very top. Whereas suddenly it would feel quite unnatural then to suddenly have one part of the game here cut off from the rest of it, where there's actually just no structural connection.
I sort of get it. So full disclosure, I'm a Blackburn Rovers fan. I sort of understand where you're coming from, because part of me would be the worst possible thing that could happen to Blackburn right now is to get promoted to the Premier League. Because it'd be a disaster. I have no interest in watching us lose 9-0 at Etihad. I've got no interest in watching that happen. And the amount of money it would take for Blackburn to become competitive in the Premier League, you'd have to sell all the players that you become attached to in the Championship, get a new manager, basically do what Fulham did, but do it successfully. And that's to go and that's to get into a league where you lose 80% of your games and scrape up on the last day. There's definitely an argument for staying in the Championship and being the eighth best team in that league forever, because you're going to win a lot of games and it's going to be very competitive football and you're going to get used to these players that become your heroes. I can understand that. Obviously, you need to have some kind of way of being of getting better overall. But I can sort of understand the idea that it's already the same as it is anyway, to a degree, in that Everton, who I mentioned the Everton problem in the piece, they are never going to win the Premier League. So it's almost as if we're in a sort of mini Super League thing already, to a degree.
That's another thing I was thinking about. So, and this argument has obviously come up a lot in Scotland because of these long-term debates about whether Celtic and Rangers join the Premier League. But so if, and then suddenly Hearts and Hibs can challenge for the title again. So say if the top six clubs are lopped off into a Super League, or top five clubs, given Spurs weren't part of the last round of negotiations, if Everton and Newcastle or whoever are then winning titles, do those titles feel cheaper? Does it feel the same sort of thing? I know that's kind of an emotional, instinctive reaction, but it is. I mean, ultimately, that's what football is about too.
And surely it wouldn't take long for the kind of league to become divided in the way that it has now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the thing, because of the inherent structure of football.
Well, yeah, if you're a very good player, why would you sign for anybody in the Premier League if you're never going to be in the European Super League? You'd much rather be on the bench for one of the Super League teams than be a starter in the new Premier League, I think.
Yeah.
So it's it would be inevitable what would happen. It would collapse without the big six.
Imagine the grimness. Even the idea of career trajectories then, where you have like your 4 or 5 years in the Super League, and then the shame of having to drop down, like, you know, you've not been picked for the draft by Real Madrid or 18th place, Christ no, 18th place Arsenal.
Okay, we're going to come on to a few more questions at the end of the show. I think it's probably time for a break. We'll see you in a bit.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to a very depressing episode of the Indie Football Podcast. However, this is the section in which the gloom will lift, because we're going to move on to talking about things we can do to save football in approximately 20 minutes. So Miguel, your second piece on the topic is due to be published tomorrow, which is Friday morning. One of the things you kind of nosed a piece on is solidarity payments. Do you maybe want to explain what those are, and could they be the answer to bridging the gap?
Well, they should be. I mean, because ultimately, if anyone really wants to solve this problem in football, it is ultimately a Das Kapital-style revolution where the resources are redistributed around the game. And so UEFA solidarity payments are at least a mechanism for that. And it's whereby the massive money generated by UEFA competition, that a certain percentage is circulated around clubs that don't participate so that the gaps are bridged. But the problem is that because of the heft of the big clubs and how much of the pie they want to keep, in the last few cycles, that percentage actually gone down. Now, the European Leagues Association, they actually want it at 20%. Presently, it's 7.3%, having come down from 8.5%. And that's really so low a figure that it's basically just a sop. It's almost a meaningless figure because it's so low. And these discussions are ongoing now. And that, I mean, if every major competition distributed or redistributed about 20%, if the Premier League did it, it would have a huge effect. I think as Goldblatt says in the piece, it would even have a massive effect on, say, the state of grassroots pitches in the country. Mm. But there are various, both individual decisions and structural factors that prevent this.
Another thing you talk about is a more equitable TV rights distribution deal. The Premier League's obviously benefited a lot from this. If the other 14 teams are able to kind of retain the current deal or a deal similar to it, could we see that be replicated elsewhere?
Yeah, Spain are trying to go that way. And it's obviously been very successful in the Premier League. Although we've now got the first problem where, for the first time since the Premier League was founded, some of that has been changed through the international distribution, which has now been loaded in favour towards the Finnish those clubs to finish highest a bit more. And the ratio will now be 1 to 1.8 rather than 1 to 1.6 in terms of what you can total get. But I was talking to Cortese, actually directly told me this. He's on the record. He said one of the clubs was actually in favour of this, because he said the chairman of that club was able to go to any of his managers and say, well, no, you can't have more money because we've got these restrictions, which is absolutely like an insane point of view and kind of, is one of them. If the game is forcing people to think like this, it's just, I mean, it's almost a mind scrambling point of view from various perspectives.
I suppose the wider problem with these kind of measures is that, yeah, they might protect, you know, 16 teams or 14 teams in the rest of the top flight, but local teams, grassroots teams, lower league teams, they're going to continue to struggle.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's something that Miggs has touched on already. It's the sort of one of the things that comes back every time you write something like this is that, oh, what about the American system, basically, where it's the NFL have a collective bargaining agreement where if someone buys a Dallas Cowboys shirt, then the Green Bay Packers, a much smaller market, get a portion of the money. And that's sort of what the entire 32-team NFL league is built on, is that it's socialism by the 32 biggest capitalists in the country. That obviously doesn't work in a system where there's 92 league clubs and then infinite more below that. I think that's the what we're basically saying here in the how do we fix it. It's somehow redistributing the unbelievable wealth at one point and giving it to other people. It's, but the sort of logistics of that are almost impossible given how many clubs and how many individuals and how many like entities are affected by football in this country and in Europe.
We've spoken on this podcast before about the erosion of Rule 34 at the height of Thatcherism. If you didn't listen or you don't know, Rule 34 restricted the payment of dividends to owners, prevented the payment of directors, which all ended when Spurs were floated on the stock market. We're now set for at least another 5 years of Tory rule. It's certain that the issues aren't gonna be addressed by government. Given that we're solely reliant on the Premier League and their Fit and Proper Persons Act, should we be worried now that we're at a point of no return and that, you know, a great many of our football clubs are going to be sold and there's no way of getting them back?
Oh, totally. And I see, and the Premier League is in a little bit of a bind here because it doesn't actually have that much power, because it's really just almost a collective of clubs rather than kind of a top-down structure. And I, from what you hear, this is why they so struggled to fill the CEO role for so long, because anyone come into the job realised, well, I'm going to be totally subject to the powers of the biggest clubs. Mm. So yeah, and the other side of it, what's so crucial about that rule change in the 80s was that it actually at least acknowledged the social value of clubs in a way that nothing has since. And by allowing that to be sidestepped, it meant that role of clubs was sidestepped now. And it's been almost a free-for-all, really.
I suppose this comes back to what we're talking about, where, like, do fans have a sort of moral responsibility? Because if you look at a club like Newcastle, fair enough, they've wanted to get rid of Mike Ashley for years and years and years, and yet to kind of welcome a potential takeover from, like, a dubious source, I suppose that sums up where we are.
Yeah, well, I suppose it goes back to what we mentioned before about fans just being more ingrained and more entrenched in their club than before. You don't really see the wood for the trees, do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I kind of think we're kind of in this mess for the long haul, maybe even permanently, because we've ended up creating this monster where we are getting fans wanting a takeover from a regime like that, where it doesn't matter how...
It's absolutely mental.
But yeah. It doesn't matter how, whether you outline all the human atrocities and this, that and the other, and just how they generally run their state.
But you might sign Neymar.
Exactly, yeah. Or you might even be linked with Neymar. And that's enough for some people. What a great example of how, you know, I mean, you don't really need to go far to see how football should be. You just need to jump into the Championship and see, I suppose, just talk to fans in the Championship and you see that they have that quintessential thing of, I suppose, gallows humour, of appreciating the fact that you're going to, you know, the rough is going to come with the smooth. Mm. And if you're lucky, you might break out of that and enjoy yourself and enjoy a day out, maybe hopefully get into a playoff and whatever and things like that. But you saw how quickly it took City fans to go from, God, why does all this shit happen to us? To, well, we deserve everything. You know, we deserve all these trophies. You know, we've got the best manager in the world, we've got the best team in the world, and I'll defend that to the hilt. It happens so quickly. You give people a taste of success and even sustain the success over 5 years, and suddenly their whole mindset completely changes. And with that, obviously, your fan base widens because you become more attractive to, you know, fans overseas, and you see, for example, even anecdotally, you see more and more Man City shirts around. You've always seen Liverpool shirts around, but City was, for me, I suppose, the breakout. And maybe you can throw Chelsea in there as well, as a team who are now, you know, ubiquitous around football fans. I've totally lost the thread of my point here, because I honestly just can't see how you can row back. And, you know, the Newcastle fans are a great example, that a team that pride themselves in being, you know, one club city who really appreciate what it is to be a club from the northeast are happy to just throw that away for just even a hint of a sniff of success.
Sticking with your point about the Championship and maybe looking a little lower, is the only realistic answer at this point to kind of ignore all of the institutions and the people with all the money and to go local and to invest time and money in lower leagues?
But I suppose it's Yeah, I mean, yes. I suppose the answer is yes, but then how do you go about doing that? I think it's really interesting when you see this kind of non-league revolution that's happened in this country. But actually, if you look at it a bit closely, you know, it's Dulwich Hamlet, it's, you know, Peckham, it's, you know, Clacton. It doesn't really happen across the country, does it? Mm. It just happens in affluent areas where people have a bit of spare money.
Also, there's a bit of social cachet with Dulwich Hamlet as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it, you know, it doesn't happen. It's not going to happen across the board because there are a lot of places in the country, you know, you see with HS2, don't you, about this issue of connecting different parts of the country. It just, I don't think it's, unless it's actually doing it in a sustained way where you end up having to rebuild communities around this club, because the reason a lot of the clubs are falling by the wayside is because they've just been drained socioeconomically around them, and they're, you know, it's the next step of doing that. All the infrastructure falls away and you get situations like Bury and whatnot. So, you know, yes, that's a great idea, but I just don't see how you'd ever actually execute it properly without, you know, as you mentioned before, change from the government.
What's the kind of bottom line of your piece on Friday, Miguel? What's the kind of conclusion that you how do you save football?
There is no change, but I don't think there is saving it. And I think the conclusion we have basically is that if you don't just want a situation where 10 to 12 clubs are winning all these games, or winning 80 to 90% of trophies and matches perpetually, then the only change to that is actually a Super League. Because I, with the current structure, I can't see how how it can be changed. I don't think there's the will there, because you keep at every turn, you just find an obstacle. If you want redistribution, then suddenly the big clubs are flexing their muscles. So it would basically take a total realignment of the attitudes of the big clubs. But that's just not going to happen when, you know, Liverpool are owned by venture capitalists. Manchester City are owned by a sports washing exercise. So, I mean, they haven't taken over these clubs for the welfare of the game. It's why they're going to keep pushing in that regard. Then if you look at something like, as we're talking about, if you were to try and bring in some sort of American system, well, that's impossible, because football is it's hugely global with so many different locations within it. There's no centralized league, and UEFA and FIFA are only ever kind of facilitators or overall umbrellas rather than truly deeply legislative bodies in that way. And any league that kind of brings in any sort of centralized system, they're not going to go for it, because it immediately puts their league at a disadvantage to other leagues. Although the Sweden thing is interesting. I do reference this in the piece, where they've basically gone for a 50+1 model, and it's been at the cost of commercial investment in the Swedish league. But what it has done is create one of the most kind of vibrant leagues in Europe, and it's in a really healthy state in terms of what the competitiveness and what the game looks like. But it's obviously maybe, it doesn't have the gloss or the money of neighbouring leagues like Denmark.
I think it's quite interesting. Something not actually mentioned in the first piece that Miguel did, something really interesting from David Goldblatt, where he says it's almost like, what is this all for?
Yeah.
Like, if it's only 10 clubs can win something, it's just one business trying to outdo another business. At a certain point, it's like, what is the point of all this? Perhaps the end game is these companies who aren't actually invested in the clubs themselves, just in what it means to be part of it, then maybe they lose interest and they go for something else. And then that's when we sort of get our football back, kind of thing. Perhaps, whether that's sort of a fanciful pie in the sky idea, I don't know. But if they could so easily pick up like we said, Newcastle, then they could quite as easily drop them again in the same way.
Yeah.
And maybe that's where the sort of the future comes, when it's sort of we're out of this bubble again and we sort of go back to where we were before. I'm not sure if that's an entirely fanciful idea or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Glazers are a classic example there. I mean, what they're in Manchester United to make money, and everything about the ownership of the club has been geared towards that. So they're not suddenly going to take, I mean, whatever about some of the decisions like TV rights, they're not going to suddenly want to give back chunks of what United are currently, their potential earnings, for the good of the game, because that's not for the good of the Glazers, what they're ultimately in this for.
Just before we wrap up, there's a couple more questions I think it would be quite good to talk about that jumped out. One from yesterday that we've kind of discussed. Is the financial disparity driven by supporters instead of clubs? We buy the TV subscriptions, we pay the ticket prices, we read the gossip.
I suppose this is kind of like, it's a societal argument as well, isn't it? Which I think is maybe, it's a bit unfair to put on people because, you know, individual people are just kind of, they're interested and want to watch a bit of football.
Yeah.
And like, they're being as fleeced as anyone else. They've been victims of capitalism in the sense that if you look at, if what, 10, 15 years ago, you could have watched one or two subscriptions, you could have watched all the European major leagues. Now you've got to get, what, four or five different ones. If you want to watch all the Premier League, you've got BT, Sky, then you've got Premier Sports. So I think while it's fair to ask for more agency from people, it's unfair to kind of put the problem down to them, because it's, I suppose this is have you ever seen that documentary, The Corporation? I think it was on Netflix, right? I don't think it's anymore, where it points out the problem with global capitalism in this way. Even if people are, even if there are obviously individual forces taking decisions that lead to these inequalities, just it's the way the system works, in that it's aggressive in itself, and just it's almost almost like an AI just pushing everything, and that influences the decisions of individual people.
One more that I think you've already been tweeting about, and we were discussing before the show, are Tottenham a super club, and would Spurs beating Liverpool last year not have been the Champions League equivalent of Leicester winning in the league?
I actually this is one thing I kind of slightly regret from the piece. Not regret, but I've been thinking about it more. High on up in it, we've got a list of the super clubs, which you've taken from the Deloitte Super League, and I think, or the Deloitte Football Money League. And I think that was actually the wrong way to go about it, because the only reason that Spurs have jumped into that top 10 is because of that one freak season in the Champions League. Well, not freak, but that one outlier of a season in the Champions League where they suddenly got an extra 100 million. Mm. So that's not income they can regularly rely on. And if you look at their commercial income, it's way lower than even some of the clubs that they've jumped ahead of, like Chelsea and Arsenal. So I think the Spurs are an interesting case in that way. I think they're just on the brink of Super League status or Super Club status. And I mean, there will be the argument now, well, if Spurs can do it, anyone can do it. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, it's come from basically Daniel Levy's specific mindset and, you know, a painstaking process in which every inch has been fought for. But they have so many advantages. I mean, the 90s, if you look at the opening of the Premier League, they're one of England's four wealthiest clubs. That stayed the case right till the end of the 90s. And secondly, they're based in London, with a huge fan base already. And that's just such a massive advantage.
And I suppose Spurs floating on the stock market was one of these huge events that kind of set a lot of this
emotion. Yeah, totally, yeah.
Okay, thank you. That's all we've got time for this week. If you are one of the three people who has not read Miguel's piece, make sure you do. We're going to link to it in the description. His follow-up piece will be published on Friday, and there will be a further piece published at the start of next week, exclusive to subscribers on Independent Premium. To read that and plenty more, take advantage of our current offer. You can sign up for just £3 for the first 3 months. Visit independent.co.uk/subscribe for more info. If you're a new listener, please subscribe to the show on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.